Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Conservative black thinker John McWhorter doesn't care for an awful lot of people who claim to care for black America. Jesse Jackson comparing the New Orleans Convention Center to a slave ship does blacks no favor, he says. Neither do rappers 50 Cent or Mos Def or Kanye West claiming Bush doesn't care about black people. Neither, says McWhorter, is there salvation in what he calls the misguided white benevolence that followed the civil rights movement. John McWhorter looks back to the social fabric of black communities in the 1950s and says, where has that gone? Up next on Point, John McWhorter and the conservative take on black America, 2006. Joining me now from New York is John McWhorter. His new book out today is Winning the Race Beyond the Crisis in Black America. John McWhorter, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being with us. You had Losing the Race a few years back and turned a lot of heads with it. What's your new message in Winning the Race, Mr. McWhorter?
Well, the new message is that I think we need to get rid of the idea that black America's problems, and of course there are plenty of them, won't go away until there's a massive revolution in the way America happens to work, and until white America gets on its knees and has some sort of grand psychological realization. And I'm saying that not because those previous two things wouldn't be nice, but because I just can't see any sign that they're going to happen. And in the meantime, I think that we should have a genuine concern for people who've been left behind. And it seems to me that much of the reason that many of us think that what's needed is some kind of revolution is because of a certain take on recent black history that is presented as an explanation for why the ghettos took such a bad turn starting in the early 70s. And from what I've seen, I don't think that that analysis is correct. And so I try to give what I and many other people think is a better analysis in Winning the Race. Then from there, I try to look at various race issues that concern us and show how if we look at these things through a new lens that rejects utopianism in favor of pragmatism, then there's more hope than we might think.
You've got an economic analysis or counter-analysis going on here, a cultural analysis as well. Take us in there, John McWhorter. How would you describe first? Let's put the white role to the side for a moment. There's a big rift in the black community's own analysis of what's going on in these past decades. How would you describe that rift?
Well, schematically, you can put it this way. We're often told that the informed view is that the reason that black inner cities became so particularly awful and violent and desolate starting in the late 60s and early 70s was because of economic factors and various results of racism. And so a couple of quick things are that we're told that low-skill manufacturing jobs, like factory jobs, left the inner cities, and therefore there was an employment crisis. Or we're taught that when the black middle class was able to move out, that black poor people had no role models and therefore could not do anything except start to shoot each other in the face. Or to give a quick third one, we're taught that the way housing project buildings were constructed was such that they encouraged crime and they discouraged community, and so therefore how could you possibly not have the community breakdown that we saw? All those things make perfect sense. The people who've argued those things are well-intentioned. They are deeply informed and brilliant people. But if we've ever felt that any of those things felt kind of counterintuitive, and I always did, even when I was told these things when I was young, the fact is that they're counterintuitive because there's a great deal of evidence against them. And I think that what really happened to black communities was that starting in the late 60s, a lot of people who wanted things to go better actually ended up creating more harm than they were aware of. But that would bring us into the white role you were talking about, and so maybe we should just table that for now.
Well, let's look at an example. You spend a good bit of time in the book looking at Indianapolis as an example of what happened with industry, what happened with a black community. To take us into that and the lessons you have drawn from it.
Yeah, Indianapolis is a way of approaching these things in what you might call a scientific way. So, for example, you can look at Chicago. You can see that factory jobs withdrew to the suburbs. You can see that all of a sudden there was massive unemployment and people living with single mothers who weren't prepared to take care of them and casual violence in black neighborhoods. And you can think of there being a correlation. However, to really make the correlation, one would have to look at a lot of cities and see whether, if, for example, the factory jobs stayed more or less where they were, you did or didn't find the same developments. And this is something which, with all respect to the sociologists who've looked at this, you don't see in the August literature on what's called deindustrialization. In Indianapolis, you had factory jobs moving slightly, but to nothing approaching the degree of many cities. Indianapolis is not the only city like this, but it was always the case right through the 70s, 80s, 90s, and even today that low-skilled jobs happen to be available to somebody who wants them. Nevertheless, in Indianapolis, for what I think are completely different reasons, the same inner-city breakdown occurred. So we have to look to other factors to explain what happened to black communities, and I think that when we look at them, we see that it wasn't things that are completely beyond our control and are results of a racism that no one can do anything about. It was other sorts of things which give us actually a more proactive view on what to do and not to do in the future.
You look back to the 1950s, and you've got almost a kind of I'm not sure how to put this, a black Norman Rockwell gloss on it. The social fabric of black communities stronger, healthier in the 50s before the civil rights movement than in later decades, than today, you would say. Am I reading you right on that? And what do you, what's the evidence and what do you take from it if it's true?
Well, I see what you mean, but I would have to say it's not Norman Rockwell. And in fact, there's a whole chapter where I try to dig into the literature on those early black communities and show that they were by no means paradise. They were often described as slums, and they were. And they had their underbelly, just like any community of any kind has even today, no matter what color the people are that are in it.
But you say we must turn back the clock. The faster we do, the better.
Yeah, those times would be better than what we had, for example, in, say, 1990. So it's not that it was perfect then and horrible now. It's that back then, things were a lot less imperfect than they are today. And what was good about those communities was simply that there was a certain sense that there were ways that things were to be done. And I'm not being nostalgic about this, but what's interesting to me is why that would start to break away so quickly in the late 60s. So, for example, in Chicago, in the 1920s, black Chicago. Not paradise by any means. Look at St. Clair Drake and Horace Caton's study of this area, and you see all sorts of hideous things. Richard Wright's photographic record of these neighborhoods. But 15% of black babies were born out of wedlock, and that was considered a problem, just 15%. Mm. Whereas by 1995, you have situations where it's three-quarters of babies who were born with only one parent, and in neighborhoods like this, a parent who usually isn't in a position to give them the best of lives. The issue is, what created the change? And you see the same sorts of things with unemployment, with violence. Read about a black slum in the 20s, and you read about a glum place. By no means Norman Rockwell, or not anything that he was given to painting. But one would almost wish to live in those slums compared to what they became. And the historian's question must be, what happened? And that's what I try to question in Winning the Race, what our historians have told us.
And there's a couple of things then that you pull on the stage. One is, you say, a liberal policy pushed in no small degree by a benevolent white impulse. And the other, a kind of black cultural embrace of what you call therapeutic alienation. What's that?
Yeah, this is the double whammy. One of them is the first thing that you mentioned, which is that welfare policy changed in the late 60s. It's not just about welfare. Of course, we should have welfare policies and generous ones. But starting in the late 60s, welfare became a program that you could live on for generations and that was very easy to get on and where no one was concerned with whether or not you ever got a job again. And this was something that was aimed deliberately at poor blacks with benevolent intent. And what was desired did not happen, and it created a major change in what poor black communities were like, and it's a lost chapter in black history, partly because it wasn't something that happened all at one time such that it made headlines. Many much more interesting things were making headlines about black America in the late 1960s. But those changes in what aid to families with dependent children was really had a kamikaze effect upon black America, despite the fact that the people who did this, white and black alike, thought that they were doing good, and it's understandable why they did. Then, on the other hand, in the same era, the idea of what activism was changed. And it was in a purely human fashion. You see this with all movements for justice and all movements for change, which is that when you're trying to turn things upside down, on the one hand, you're trying to accomplish something. But then on the other hand, there's a certain theatricality that's inherent to it. There's a certain personality type that is best at it. And what often happens is that once most of the goals have been accomplished, the goals that people were interested in the beginning, then there is a residue, which is that that theatrical part still needs a channel. Next thing you know, people start moving in who are more moved by the theatrics alone than by the actual activist, proactive, pragmatic message. This isn't about black people. This is about people in general. You saw this in the Vietnam War movement. You can see this in 1848 in Europe. There's always that particular type who's more interested in the drama. The problem is that with the civil rights movement, once certain formal things happened, such as the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, and a general revolution in how race was conceived of and paid attention to, at least by thinking white people in this country, then the stage was set for a certain kind of person who was more interested in just the idle theatrics than in actually changing anything.
I'm interested, John, in how you respond to what you're hearing. In effect, whites wanted to create this dependency. Now, is that this awful alienation in a black voice that you don't like or not?
No, not originally. And that, if we talk about how these things are more complicated than we're often told, mm-hmm. then one way in which that is true is that the whites who, for example, turned welfare upside down with poor blacks in mind did have benevolent intentions. They were actually hoping to bankrupt the social system so that there would be a guaranteed income for everyone. Now, that's a very hard left goal, but it was certainly benevolent. And I think as a result, nevertheless, they created an awful lot of black misery. Now, are there white people who are invested in keeping blacks down? I don't see any empirical evidence for that. But I do think it's important to listen to Pat when she talks about how black communities used to be. We definitely don't need to think of it as Norman Rockwell. The issues are not, quote unquote, black and white. But we do have to keep in mind things such as a very, very quick observation. It's 1925, it's Detroit, and there are many, many, many black laborers. They are corralled mostly into slum quarters. There were many people who would have an hour and a half commute to the River Rouge Ford plant, and that's one way. And they did that. That's because one quite simply had to. Now, you go into William Julius Wilson's study of inner city Chicago, 70s and 80s, and you have many people, and these people are by no means monsters, who are casually saying, well, I wouldn't want to take a job out there because you'd have to get up really early in the morning and take a couple of buses to go. Now, we don't need to condemn that person in the 70s or 80s. It's all they ever knew, and they live in a very different inner city with very different economic arrangements. But nevertheless, what's the difference between those people in Professor Wilson's study and the people in Detroit? So the difference is not one that is made up on the basis of how elegant the photographs from the 1920s look. Something very significant really did happen, and our question has to be why.
Of course, William Julius Wilson, the Harvard Don who laid down some of the basic tenets that you're pushing back against here, saying that it was the loss of those industrial jobs in the inner city that led to so many troubles in the black community. The immigrant competition for jobs may be coming in there as well. And a lot of the people that you go after, and you go after people specifically and by name in the new book, are people that we've...
Not go after. Try to engage.
Yes, try to engage. Lovely. But it's pretty direct. Of course, it's direct from both sides. The folks we've talked to on both sides of this question, we talked to William Julius Wilson after Hurricane Katrina in the images that we saw there. And we asked him about the perception that African Americans might not be looking hard enough for work, that they're not taking the jobs immigrants are willing to take. John McWhorter, listen with me for a second, if you would, to Professor William Julius Wilson responding to that charge.
It is not the case that people are not taking jobs that that the immigrants are taking. In fact, what's happening in many cases is that immigrants are displacing a lot of domestic workers. One of the reasons that black males have such a high jobless rate is that immigrants and women have entered the labor market in significant numbers and have displaced them.
But if anyone would work for the same wages under the same circumstances, it sounds draconian. But is there a solution there? Are people just too holding out for too high a wage, even if it's barely above poverty?
Well, let me just say this.
Yes, sir.
For most domestic workers, dead-end menial jobs are really difficult to hold on and maintain. There's mm-hmm. a built-in turnover rate for
mm-hmm.
those jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And if we could make work pay, if we could sort of subsidize income and provide more fringe benefits, I think you would get workers staying in these jobs for a longer period of time.
William Julius Wilson, who laid down some of the basic arguments that John McWhorter is responding to. John McWhorter, there is the argument, subsidize income, provide more fringe benefits, make work pay. You agree?
Mm-hmm. That's such a perfect clip. This is exactly what I mean. What Professor Wilson is urging makes sense, but we have to ask, given assorted realities of our government and our sociological fabric today, whether what he prescribes is likely to happen. And since it's not, I think we have to bring into the discussion that when Professor Wilson discusses that very issue of immigrants in his work in writing, where one can expand somewhat more, then he actually also discusses, although with a certain understandable reluctance, but at an admirable length, that the issue is not only that immigrants are taking the job somehow, as if the job was a physical object that you can run and take, but that many employers tend to prefer them over, in particular, young black males because of behavioral issues with the young black males. Now, we have to beware stereotyping, but even Wilson says that there is a behavioral problem based on all sorts of other factors that he adduces, one of them being simply that many of these men have simply never known an environment where young men did not exhibit those behavioral problems. These are problems, but it shows that to say that just the immigrants are taking them is not just it. And there's another scenario, very quickly, that we might consider. Why wasn't it that the immigrants started coming after the Immigration Act of 1965 and the immigrants had a problem getting in at the back door because the people at the bottom of the social scale, uneducated African-American people, particularly young ones, were getting these jobs and holding on to them and always scrambling for them and having two at a time? Why weren't young black people presenting that problem if the good old-fashioned factory jobs were pulling away? Why weren't people using them? Now, it's hard to say why that scenario was not. And with all due respect to my elder, Professor Wilson, nowhere in his work does he provide the answer to that question.
Clifton is calling from Johnston, South Carolina. Hi, Clifton. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. How you doing today?
We're well. Happy New Year. What's on your mind, Clifton?
I agree with the speaker wholeheartedly from start to finish. In the 50s and 60s, things were a lot better. The welfare system was our undoing. When they have a system, when it started out great. But when it developed, where you got single women that's paid to have babies, the more babies you have, the more money you make. And you could get these babies by on the weekend. You could have a man live in the house with you, but come Monday morning, you got to leave. Now, what kind of system is that? That makes no sense. And to, you know, what's happening. That's the downfall of the black family structure.
And, of course, a lot of that welfare system now gone. But, Clifton, when you say the 50s were better, that's such a stark statement. I mean, many of listeners will remember the 1950s, and it didn't look so great for much of black America in those days.
Well, it's a lot worse now. I mean, I agree with the speaker. The way that things are now, you know, if I could turn back the clock, sadly to say, I would.
Wow.
There's
a big vote from South Carolina saying turn back the clock to pre-civil rights era life. Let's get another perspective, and then we'll turn to you, John McWhorter. Let me turn to Brookline, Massachusetts, and to Bill. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi.
Happy New Year, guys.
Happy New Year to you, sir. What do you think?
Listen, unbelievable. I can't believe that last caller. I don't know what he's been indulging in, maybe a little bit too much in New Year's cheer. Listen, let me give you perspective from a 60-year-old black man who grew up in the North and who has listened to the conservative canard from people like Mr. McGuire for a long time now. And fact is, it's inaccurate. There's a lot left out of this equation. Let me give you a couple pointers.
Okay.
First, heroin, 1959. When heroin came into the black community, it destroyed more black homes than any kind of welfare did. Cheap liquor, wine, crime. In fact, I grew up around Boston in the Massachusetts area where they had mills for black folk, rubber mills, shoe, textile industries.
Yep.
Black men, hundreds of them would be coming home with no fingers, no arms, eyes put out. They did the dangerous work, dirty work, and then they got beat up on the weekend by police officers from stations like District 9 and 10 that were notorious for beating up black men on the street for being drunk. I remember the blue lights coming into the South End in the 1950s where these so-called paddy wagons would come in and take black men out of the house downstairs, beating them, and people standing around watching.
Bill, we understand that, but let me just ask you, when Clifton from South Carolina looks around today and says he doesn't like the scene today either, in fact, it looks worse today than then, do you say, well, what do you say?
Each man is entitled to his opinion, but see, I'm telling you what I know.
Mm-hmm.
And the things that turned a lot of this social ill around, crime and so forth, were movements like the Black Muslim Movement. What those brothers did back in the 50s, they came into the communities, they cleaned up the drug addicts, they wore suits and ties, they opened up businesses, they told black men to respect your women, they told black men to get a job and go to work, despite all the ills in this society that black men had to face. Those were the things that turned things around, when black folks would stop being called Negroes and treated like niggers and couldn't go into South Boston to go to Carson Beach back in the 50s, where they couldn't get a decent education in the Boston public school system, where the teachers would beat you as well as punish you, and the teaching system was a lot different for black kids in the South End than it was in Brookline or Mattapan for the white kids. You understand? See, there are a whole lot of things that Mr. McGuire leaves out when he talks about welfare. Welfare was a shame quotient in the black communities in the 50s. People will hide if they were on welfare in the black communities. People who lived in these housing projects all over the Boston area who were on welfare were white, and very few were black. Black people didn't know how to get on welfare back in those days. It was a shame thing. And the few that did have it, the people who, like us who grew up middle class who didn't need it, we shamed them into having the welfare. They came to school. They came to school with food stamps and getting food. From
yeah,
the food line.
Bill, we hear it. I want to pick up both of these perspectives, if I may, with John McWhorter. And John, there's one thorough vote of support from South Carolina. Then another vote from Boston saying, "Wait a minute, it was not so great in the 50s, and there's more than welfare going on here. What about drugs, heroin, everything that came in?" A couple of different ways of looking at that time that you look back on with such fondness.
Not fondness. It's just a matter of comparison. But I think that actually both callers pretty neatly indicate what I've been talking about. Basically, my point is that there was a big change in the late 60s that things got a lot worse. And I don't think anybody, or at least most people, would not disagree with that. Police brutality was hideous way, way back, and it continues to be hideous after the 60s. I'm not sure what that has to do with it. Heroin didn't come into black communities in the 50s. You can read about it in Claude Brown's Man-Child and the Promised Land in the 40s. People are writing about it even in the 20s. The issue is what drugs do to a community, and there's drugs in 1920 versus what we're familiar with drugs in those same communities starting in the early 1980s. There's a question. And as for the shame of welfare, I don't want to talk about shame. But the fact that it was that marginal in black communities is exactly what I'm talking about. There's a reason why it wasn't marginal in black communities starting in the late 1960s. And as far as Clifton, it's very important to take from his point this simple fact. You could take me as being the quote-unquote conservative who's taking on certain sacred cows and has a quote-unquote ideology. But there are many, many, many Cliftons out there who wouldn't be given, you know, any particular labels. I don't think anybody would consider Clifton to be a conservative. And I think that we're often trained to think that Clifton is indulging in some sort of nostalgia. But in fact, he isn't. And that's what the book is interested in examining, with the reason that I think that we need to realize that what turned black communities upside down was not just racism, because the second caller shows that we had plenty of racism and inequity before, but something more complicated, and as I've said, which actually gives more hope for the future than the idea that it was things that we'll never control and that will always exist.
I want to ask you a personal question quickly. Your mom taught, as I recall, social welfare studies at Temple University. She used to drive you through the tough part of Philadelphia from your middle class suburbs so that you would see what was going on there. Does she agree with your interpretation, John?
My mother had an aneurysm in 1987, and she's now a mental invalid, so she's not in a position to. And, you know, I genuinely don't know what she would think of my views now because she was a very complex person.
But a person who grew up much more in the midst of the civil rights movement, do you end up respecting that movement from your perspective?
Very much so. Everything that happened created the life of someone like me, 40 years old today, and the mistakes that were made were things that I'm sure that the people couldn't help any more than I could if I were there. However, the fact is that there were very tragic byproducts of a very good thing that played as much of a role in our present as the better aspects of it did. And I think that a realistic historical analysis has to acknowledge that more than I'm sure we're always taught to.
John McWhorter, we'll be looking to see if there's any kind of new consensus emerging there. Clearly, not one this morning. You stake out a very interesting position. We're grateful to you for being with us. The new book is Winning the Race, Beyond the Crisis in Black America. John McWhorter, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.